Welcome to 100 Plus, a historical overview of important people, places, and ideas from the last 2,000 years. In today's episode, Mike and author Dave Moore, who recently released his book, Stuck in the Present, will discuss the importance of understanding historical events in relation to the Christian faith.
Well, welcome to 100 Plus and a new kind of podcast. Today, I have a chance to talk with David Moore, who's a friend. I have long intended, in addition to the 100 lectures on the more significant people, events and ideas of the last 2,000 to 3,000 years, this sort of merge of church history and Western civilization, I have said there's this plus, and the plus was intended to be interviews with authors, deeper dives on certain topics. Just haven't done that, but wanted to get the 100 down first. But David, a friend, longtime acquaintance and friend, lives in Austin, Texas. He is an author, has a new book out, came out a week ago. The book is called Stuck in the Present, How History Frees and Forms Christians. And since this is so specifically up the alley of this podcast, I'm breaking protocol and we're going to have some time with David to ask about his book. So you know, David is a graduate of Arizona State. He has a master's degree in biblical studies from Dallas Theological Seminary, a master's degree in Christian thought with an emphasis on church history from Trinity Divinity School. He has been a pastor. He has written three or four books. I have his book on a commentary on Ecclesiastes. He wrote a book on men's ministry. He wrote a book on hell. He also has written hundreds of articles, done lots of interviews, including, I saw, looking at his CV, that about 5 years ago, he interviewed me.
Right.
And that was right after I had had the stroke and was sort of clawing my way back and was reflecting on all of that. So now turnabout is fair play. I am interviewing David. And let me ask just as we get started. And by the way, I'm looking at this. I got the galleys.
Dennis, you got both iterations. You got the older.
Four or five months included. Ago. And that's what I read. So I got this book a couple days ago. It's unmarked, but I have read the book. I just didn't read that copy. So the book has been out for a week. That's not exactly a chance to end up on the New York Times bestseller list, but how is the book being received?
It's been really gratifying so far. My publisher sent me something even last night of a review that appeared that I hadn't seen. It was very encouraging because it described in the review, albeit brief, main things I was trying to accomplish in the book. So that was great. And as far as I know, Mike, I mean, it's available in so many different places. You know, now there's so many online, you know, Target, Walmart, it's in all those kind of places, CBD, Amazon, of course. I think some people are, you know, there's like, I think publishers said there's like at least 75 different just options for Kindle and Audible. And I just signed a contract for someone to read the book, which I don't want to read it. I want someone else to do it. And I'm hoping that person is British and has a lovely, not too thick, but, you know, can articulate the words well. But that was encouraging. So that was that's in the offing, but everything else is available. So as far as I know, I haven't seen hard numbers yet. I've heard some general numbers about how many Amazon ordered and they got backlogged. They ran out of their orders. That was a problem. So we'll see what happens. I mean, every day it's kind of putting stretch marks on my sanctification because I'm hoping to kind of see certain things. When I do, it's encouraging. And when I don't, I'm kind of like, I got to guard against getting too discouraged with the, you know, snapshot for the day. So I want to be careful.
Well, yeah, probably don't want to check your polling numbers too often.
Yeah.
That can be hard. Thankfully, pastors don't have polling numbers. Although I sort of have a general idea how I'm doing on any given moment.
I'm sure you get plenty of feedback.
I do get feedback, yes. So you argue that that history frees and informs us. So let me just start by saying not everybody would agree with that. Henry Ford is perhaps most famous for his suggestion that history is bunk and that we don't want to look backwards. We just need to look forward. And you lamented various times in your book that people, Christians in particular, I think, you're lamenting Christians in particular not knowing history, but that Americans don't know history.
Right.
So is it that bad? And if so, why?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why. There's a long history, I think, that we could trace out, and I do in the book on the head-heart stuff. As far as is it that bad, yes, I think. I don't know if I can say it's worse than what you described, because you were pretty bleak in your description. So, yes, I think it's that bad. And I think there's tangible, empirical, there's polling data, there's all kinds of stuff. I'd say we're probably living in modern American history where we have the really bad twin of great ignorance coupled with great arrogance. And so I think we all feel like we're expert and in experts in a myriad of issues, whatever it is. You know, if we haven't read the latest Georgia voting laws that have changed, we're an expert, you know, even though we haven't read the 98-page document. We can pivot to immigration. We can pivot to all kinds of issues on the, you know, economy, et cetera. So I think the modern era where you got 24/7, you got kind of shock news all the time for ratings and on social media. And that honestly is a big part of, that is a lot of the problem, is that I would say most people are trying to figure out in the present based on things that are immediately hitting them in the present. So most people are figuring out what they believe based on interactions in their echo chamber on social media and in cable news. And so, that's a big problem.
Yeah. So, by the way, I saw a poll that said, it was, I'll make this up, but I'm close. You know, U.S. ninth graders were 38th in math globally, but thought they were second. And, you know, I think it was the Koreans were first, but thought they were 12th. So The argument was, we're really good at thinking we're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tease this out a little bit. You're suggesting that we're caught in some echo chambers and we're trying to figure out the present based on the present or based on a limited perspective of the present. But your book suggests that history can provide a balance or a counterweight or insight. How exactly does history free inform us?
Well, probably a good way of illustrating it maybe would be by retrieving a famous essay by C.S. Lewis of the reading of old books, where he said that books from another time were written for their culture and time in a lot of ways. And they made their own mistakes, but they didn't make your mistakes. And so they're a helpful guide if you read a book about the Middle Ages and you read, as one famous one that I read, first page starts out that for most people living during that period, if they had a decent loaf of bread and some halfway decent wine, they offered up long prayers to God over the dinner table, right? And so that's quite a rebuke to our great plenty and wolfing it down with our soundbite prayers, et cetera. I think when we look at the modern era, Mike, you know, we look at speed, efficiency, technological advancements, et cetera. We just tend to think, because we're swimming in the water, that faster and more efficient is better. And as one guy I heard recently say, you know, he was kind of really rebuked by studying afresh the Gospels and seeing that Jesus wasn't very efficient. In fact, he jokingly said, you know, the funny thing is, I'm really more efficient than Jesus was in a lot of ways. And what hit him when he kind of studied the Gospels afresh, he said, you know, it's very simple, but I noticed in the Gospels that Jesus really saw people. When he was with them, he was really with them. He wasn't mentally multitasking. He wasn't distracted. He wasn't struggling with focus, that kind of thing. So I think old books are helpful for You know, I think the illustration, I think Andy Crouch gave this in an article, that the idea that the hearth, you know, the 19th century up to the 19th century was the focus of the house. And then design got such that the furnace now is in the garage and the center of the house for us, the TV.
Yeah.
Is that advancement? You know, I don't think so. So I think history helps us go, oh, wow, we're living in a freakishly... There's all kinds of blessings, and I know you're grateful for them. I'm grateful for them. Modern medicine, et cetera, et cetera. But to say that it's always a net benefit to, quote, progress and define progression as faster, more efficient, more done in less compressed time, you know, that's problematic.
Well, I think Lewis's essay, which I just recommended last week on the reading of old books, it's the suggestion that you can either travel or you can read history, and you're going to get a perspective that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Yeah.
So is there a particular decision that you made where you think, I've made a different decision because I've studied history? I mean, I know you've been a student of history. Is there some way that you can say, here's how history has freed and formed me?
Right. I think, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I mentioned the one thing about reading that book on the Middle Ages, and that was when I was reading it, frankly, I wasn't thinking, oh, this is for my Christian formation. What was more on my mind is I need to beef up my understanding, my cognitive awareness of the Middle Ages. So I'm going to read this book.
It's a standard book. You could have wanted some more Monty Python. I mean, that's where most people.
Yeah, that's right. And so I did, with that kind of informational mindset, but literally the first page, he introduced what I just mentioned about the bread and the wine. And it just made me realize, you know, we've always as a family done meals and had really substantial conversations a lot of times over our meals. But now we're empty nesters, and it's easy to fall prey to not making them, you know. My wife teaches full time. She's done some writing. We both can get very, very busy, and meals can take a back seat. And so that appreciation for going slower, I think, is one of the big things. I think, you know, when I think about decisions that I've made, sometimes I've made decisions that are not pragmatic decisions at all, either monetarily or even opportunity-wise. And some of those have been based on other periods of time where I've read, and I've thought, you know, take a Dietrich Bonhoeffer when he's doing his seminary, and obviously he was kind of forced into doing this underground seminary. But, you know, here he really had world-class background and education, and he very intentionally, he could have gone to Union Seminary, as you know, they were trying to get him over there, saying, look, if the Nazis are taking over Germany, you'll be safe here. We want you here, teaching position, plum position. He intentionally goes back to Germany and, of course, eventually dies. But does this really small little seminary, you know, and Life Together is obviously the famous book that kind of came from that experience. So there's been a lot of things that kind of put a check. I mean, even theological education, the decision to start a seminary kind of education out of the church was very much spawned by the log cabin model of kind of the tenants and others that did that. So there's a lot of decisions that have given me kind of reference points in history and gone, you know.
So is there, so pivoting on that, a different kind of question, having studied history, having studied, backing up Western civilization and beyond, but is there a period that has uniquely formed you, or maybe the more specific question, is there a period you wish you lived in?
Well, yeah, I as you know, I mean, because I talk about this a lot, I've struggled with, and I always say they're serial doubts, but since that's kind of a homonym, S serial, not C, because I have no doubts whatsoever about C serial. I love sea cereal. I believe it exists. I've eaten it, yeah. Experienced it. But because of that, my kind of joking answer is I would have loved to have been just outside the tomb before Jesus came out. I do believe the bodily resurrection. I think the evidence is quite strong and compelling for that. But that would have really been sealing the deal. Now, notwithstanding that Christian answer, I will pivot.
That's and the say, Jesus answer. You've
yeah,
given
the Jesus answer. That, yeah, I can't
sound
do
like that. A squirrel, but I'm sure the answer is Jesus, yes.
Right. So I would say because of my interest in early 19th century America, kind of from probably, just prior to Jackson, maybe all the way to certainly the late antebellum and into the Civil War period, and specifically the writers, some of them called transcendentalists, some not transcendentalists like Hawthorne and others, but a coterie of writers in and around Concord and other places. So I probably would, and there'd be enough creature comforts. They still wouldn't have air conditioning, but it'd be okay. It'd be not bad because it's early 19th century. Food would be decent. I'd probably like to sit in on some of those meetings with Thoreau and Emerson and Hawthorne and Melville and hear Dickinson do her poetry. If I could get her to do it in public, which would have been a stretch, it would have been challenging, but that probably is a period.
Okay. Well, I like the creature comfort, so I'm sticking here. I like antibiotics. I like my iPhone.
Right.
I like all of that, but yes, fun to think about if we could go back for a day, a few hours.
Yeah, that's the key. A few hours, I could handle anything, I think.
Right. So I know you're a big fan of the Puritans. You've been focused on them and on Puritan pastors and others.
Yeah.
Why the Puritans, and do you think they uniquely offer something in terms of forming and freeing Christians?
I do. And I need to say, Leland Ryken's got a good introduction, Worldly Saints, to the Puritans. That's pretty helpful as far as an entree into the Puritans. Got a whole chapter on failures of the Puritans. He loves the Puritans. And you can't help but say, specifically the way they treated the Quakers, Anne Hutchinson, the Salem witch trials, King Philip's War. There's just no excusing that, even with the times and whatnot. Notwithstanding a lot of their weaknesses, and, here they come over, at least the pilgrims, the Puritans were actually pilgrims, because not all Puritans were pilgrims, but all pilgrims were Puritans. But the pilgrims that came over, obviously they, among other things, they wanted religious liberty. And of course, that didn't really translate to the Quakers and others. But I think their positive, Mike, is that they, especially the pastors, the early Puritan pastors, really modeled, some people see Edwards as the end of the Puritans, a really strong tethering of what we would call the heart and the head. And I have a whole kind of early section, as kind of tracing the history, starting with the Puritans to the modern era. I think they show that there should be no dichotomy between the two. So, their sermons were robust. They're preaching a lot of times to farmers and people with very little formal education. So you got these Cambridge, Oxford people preaching to farmers. You've got long sermons. You've got literacy super high. Neil Postman talks about that in Amusing Ourselves to Death, that there's probably never been a time where literacy rates were so high as in Puritan New England. So I think their model of the head or heart, and the other thing too that I really like about them is I think they did an incredible job of tethering biblical hope with a thick realism. So you've got, here's just one example. I could give other examples, but one example that's maybe the most dramatic, at least that I've read, in Richard Baxter's Saints Everlasting Rest. And Richard Baxter's on kind of my short list of favorite Puritans. Bunyan's on that list as well. But Richard Baxter, a pastor, said, and Saints Everlasting Rest. Now, he believed God could do miracles, God could do big things, but he believed God was sovereign. And he had a sense of the tragedy of living east of Eden that was realistic, and yet God could still do all kinds of things. But in Saints Everlasting Rest, he says, when you're doing, and you'll definitely resonate with this as a pastor, he said, when you're going to visit someone who has the really bad combination of being physically very sick, but mentally, they use the word typically, melancholy in personality. He basically said, to translate in the vernacular, good luck. You know, that's pretty much a hopeless situation. Unless there's a parting of the Red Sea, like, you know, the Exodus, that person is probably going to be remain in a desperate place. And I remember, and a lot of people would read that and go, don't these guys believe in miracles? Don't they believe, like, you know, where's the sense of trusting in God? You have to read more fully in that book to see that, but where the hope is. But that kind of, because a lot of them suffered, you know, John Owen, who's probably the brightest Puritan, lost a lot of children, most of them dead. So they knew suffering.
Yep. Well, and as you alluded to, they also, you know, the average farmer attending church knew a lot of theology, had been schooled. There was not a lot of competition. There's not a lot of, you know, Netflix shows that they could be watching. And so they're thinking about these things. And I have mentioned, just to sort of scandalize the pretty highly educated congregation that I serve, that I couldn't actually get away with preaching a sermon, a Puritan sermon from the, you know, 16th or 17th century, because I said, well, it's very, they're very long. You think I'm long? They're long. But they're also, they just assume a level of biblical literacy that I can't assume.
Yeah.
And so it is surprising. There's a lot. Yes. The Puritans have their issues and some bad press that they don't deserve, but they also have done some things well.
I should add one thing on the Puritans, Mike, to add to that, just kind of as a final remark, is that for those who maybe have kind of an impression of what a Puritan sermon would be like, very dense, heavy, abstract theology, usually half of it was pushing the application from the exposition in the first half. So literally 50% of it would typically, and even the exposition, if you read those sermons, you know, Harry Stout's read a lot of them, but if you read those sermons, even the so-called exposition isn't always totally sequestered from the application. They're just constantly pressing the implications of what they're saying. So it's like one big application.
I believe people today call that meddling.
Yeah, they meddled a lot.
You're meddling. Yes. Just, well, so this is here's an understatement. This is a confused and contentious moment. A lot of tension in the system right now. And I'm wondering, do you have any, what does history suggest about a moment like this? How will history look at this moment? You know, I mean, we've got the left versus the right, conservatives versus liberals. You got progressives. You got every end of the radio dial has got a particular slant and a lot of adrenaline. So is there a historical insight that you might bring, or a historical perspective that you might share?
I think what I hear in many conversations I've had, and undoubtedly you've had the same kind of inclination one way or another, I'd say Christians, and I'm written this book specifically, obviously, for Christians, so I think non-Christians would, I mentioned it to my neighbor, and I think he might read it. He's not religious at all. I think there's two equal and opposite errors that Christians make when it comes to history. And I think people of the past would say, don't make this mistake. One would be to say, our time is so freakishly unique and is so freakishly troubled and it's so freakishly fractured and difficult, et cetera. They never, no other culture ever had the internet. That's true. But I think pushing the utter uniqueness of our time is a danger. I think flattening out the unique struggles of our time is also a danger. I'd say probably more Christians make the first mistake than the latter one. So, you know, there are some Christians that will say, you know, there's a lot that we could learn from Christians before Constantine and really Theodosius in the late fourth century, when Christians didn't have much power and they didn't have the corridors and they were on the margins and they were persecuted with all the waves of Nero to Decius and Diocletian, all those guys. And they would, that's a helpful comment in saying, hey, we're not so freakishly odd that we have nothing to learn from the past. But then to say, we're just like the disillusion of Rome, you know, to make that mistake, which I think is a big mistake. To say there's nothing we can learn from the disillusion of Rome, I think that's a mistake. To say that there's like one-to-one correspondence, it's a perfect analog for us, I think is, again, the other mistake. So I'd say in thinking historically, a lot of historians will say, use this phrase, that we need to appreciate the oddness of the past, not just retrieve it for talking points or something that we can straitjacket into something that we already believe, but let it tell us something that might really challenge us, you know, and that we can bring into our present that can help us. So, I do think we can't probably, you know, I see a lot of American historians saying that they believe we're living in a time where the American experiment is the most the idea of the American experiment is the most overtly contested. And I think that's factual. I think that's true. So it's a tough time.
Yeah. I think it is a tough time. I just was reading John Dickerson's got a new book out, Bullies and Saints. And he talks about, you know, he's this Australian pastor, church historian, ancient historian, sort of public intellectual down under. But so he's talking about the best moments, the saints, who he says are pretty rare. And he talks about the bullies and bullies within the church. But I heard a podcast where he was being interviewed and they said, what was the worst time? The worst time in the church, I guess the question is, what was the most grievous mistake or problem created by the church? Was it the Inquisition, the Crusades? You know, where are you going to go? And he said, worst thing that happened in the church, the worst thing the church has ever done is the 20th century cover-up of the pedophile problem in the Catholic Church. Hmm. That has done more to sort of unravel things. So there are some uniquenesses about this moment, but you got to also remember, you know, when people say it's never been this contentious in the United States, and you say, there was a civil war, yeah. You know, we can't be completely dismissive of this. Well, yeah. So let me say this.
Yes.
Talking to Dave Moore, this is his book. Just came out this week, and let me pitch two final questions to you here, Dave. So you suggest that the study of history can build hope. I think we all want hope. What do you mean by hope? I'm assuming you're not suggesting optimism, but hope. So what do you mean by hope, and how does the study of history lead to hope?
Well, I appreciate that question because I think, you know, we bandy out these words all the time, faith, hope, and love, as if we really understand the biblical contours of them. And I've asked, you know, different groups that I've spoken to, Christians, and said, you know, could you give me the boundaries biblically of what makes faith, faith biblically, and love, love biblically, and hope, hope biblically, and when does it get compromised? And a lot of people have said, I cannot give you Bible verses to explain that. Hope biblically is something that's certain. It's not guessing, wondering, wish fulfillment, maybe it'll happen, that sort of thing. It's grounded in the promises, the character and or promises of God. So it's a settled fact that these things are going to happen that give us hope. You know, most of them are in the future. And of course, we know from Paul and Jesus, and certainly in the Gospel of John, the realities of the kingdom of God are already breaking in. So it's already been, as theologians like to say, inaugurated in some sense, just in seed form. So I think what history does, and certainly as a Christian, you know, wanting to think hopefully in a, again, a biblical sense, is it reminds me that there are people that have gone before me. You know, I mentioned doubts. You know, it's very encouraging to read about people that I really look up to, what they did, the courage and the perseverance they had, and yet struggled with great doubts, and yet God helped them through that. So seeing the work of the Holy Spirit throughout the full sweep of the church, the unfolding of God's work in different periods of the church, where there are all kinds of challenges, all kinds of difficulties, some that I would not, frankly, wanted to be around for, you know, I just look at them and go, wow, it's amazing how courageous and clear people were. So that gives me hope to say, okay, well, in my time, how can I then ground my challenges that I have in my own little world that I'm living locally here to say, okay, that gives me all these reference points of people that were courageous and did things and benevolent things and loving things. And because they believed that their ultimate hope was God and the new heavens and new earth. And so this world was not their ultimate hope. And they lived that out in example after example. And, you know, Chesterton has this great quote that I have in the book that says, in his estimation, one of the reasons why a lot of us don't like looking back at history is because we see real people that already accomplished real things and we have to measure our life accordingly. So everyone's got flaws, but the one reference points that I'm talking about now are the kind where people did really remarkable things in very dire circumstances.
Yes, much to learn and be encouraged by, challenged by, repositioned by. So thank you for your work. May sales soldier on, and I'm sure you're working on a new book. So your new book is, did I hear, Emerson?
It is. Thanks for asking. Michael Haken, who teaches church history, is an expert on the Puritans, early church, and Jonathan Edwards. I think he's written three or four books on Edwards. He had been reading some of my stuff for a while and reached out to me and said, hey, if you want to, I would love to do a book with you if you're ever interested. You come up with the idea and let's do it together. So it didn't take me very long because I started thinking about him. I just thought, well, I'm really interested. I was kind of working already on Emerson for many years. Didn't know what I was going to do with it all, but I knew there was some book in there. And then I thought, let's put Emerson in conversation with Edwards. Now they were born literally 100 years apart from each other. Edwards 1703, Emerson 1803. But me playing kind of the Emerson skeptic about Christianity, I get to pose hard questions to Mr. Christian and see how he does.
So very Peter Kreeft-like with his book on Kennedy and Lewis and Huxley.
Exactly.
November 22nd, 1963. And then you get another one, I think, on Socrates, right? Unaborted Socrates.
Yeah, both were great.
Well, hey, so thanks for your time today.
Thanks for your book.
Thanks for reminding us that if you want to figure out the present, you have to look backwards. It starts there. So,
amen.
Okay. Well, so that's it for this particular special podcast, and we'll continue down the path of 100 in the next podcast. Have a good day.